Feinstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.
This is Dave Mazza with Voices from the Edge. This Friday marks the 144th anniversary of the end of slavery in the United States. June 19th, or Juneteenth as it is known, is not only a day to commemorate the end of slavery, but to reflect on the progress made and the challenges that remain to overcome racism. This week on Voices from the Edge, Joanne and I look at how Oregonians are contributing, or not, in this important struggle. First, we'll talk with Sha'an Mulier, a community activist, educator, and co-founder of the African American Alliance of the Northeast Kingdom, about her work to dismantle white privilege. Next, we'll talk with Oregon Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian about new efforts by his agency to combat racism in the workplace and elsewhere in Oregon. And as always, we'll be talking with you. Is there reason for celebration this Juneteenth? What work remains to be done and how best to do it? Join the conversation this Thursday at 8 a.m. on Voices from the Edge on KBOO 90.7 FM.
And it is just 1 minute past 11 a.m. You are listening to KBOO in Portland. And coming up next, it's the food show. So do stay tuned.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. You know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families...
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Laura McCandlish.
Coming up, we've got a lot of things for you all. Laura?
We're going to have an interview with Elise Pearlstein, the producer of the new documentary, Food Inc., that may make you want to lose your appetite and never eat again.
Or at least become vegetarian. We also have the Jamming for the Hungry program, where Corvallis and Philomath volunteers turn gleaned fruit into low-sugar jams and jellies for local food banks.
And we'll feature an interview with local cookbook author Linda Ziedrich on tips and recipes from her newly published The Joys of Jams, Jellies, and Other Sweet Preserves.
And finally, we'll have Canning Jams and Fruits with the Oregon State University Extension Service's Master Food Preserver Program. But first up, we have the producer of Food Inc., Elise, I'm hoping we're saying it right, Pearlstein. Elise, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. I got to tell you, Laura and I went to the press screening yesterday, and I think we were both a little shocked by the movie.
I had nightmares last night.
Oh, no.
I guess what we're wondering is, you know, there have been a lot of books out, and you had a lot of the authors, you know, including Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, featured extensively in the movie. Why'd you make this movie?
Well, the movie actually started 6 years ago as a collaboration between the director, Robert Kenner, and Eric Schlosser. And originally it was going to kind of just be a film version of his book. But as time passed and things changed, the film really evolved to just kind of be a bigger look at kind of the current state of our food system and you know, what has kind of happened with the big changes over the last 50 years as our food system has become more and more industrialized.
Yeah, that's interesting, because going into the movie, the first thing I thought was, oh, is this going to be like the movie version of the book? And there were some parts that were similar to the book, but there was a lot more information there.
Right.
How did you decide which things? There was quite a lot of things that were covered also.
It's a huge subject.
Yeah, going from, the industrialization of the farms to Stonyfield Farms being in Walmart.
Right, right. And, I mean, really the idea for the film was to kind of look at how our food gets to the table from many different points of view. And, as you can tell in the film, we had a harder time getting some points of view in than others because we didn't have a whole lot of cooperation from some of the bigger food companies.
Can you just expand on that a minute? Who particularly did you not get cooperation from?
From finding the story or the farmer first and then kind of wanting to get the comments from the company. And we approached Smithfield, Tyson, Purdue, and Monsanto specifically to be in the film, and none of them wanted to participate. We also talked to many other food corporations and even supermarkets. We wanted to film in and talk to them about what they were doing, and we really didn't... did not have an open door.
I'm curious, what was your approach? What did you tell them about the movie, and who did you speak to at the firms? Did you not even get past the press officer?
It depended. You know, it really was a case-by-case basis, and it really depended on the story. We kind of talked to them about the fact that we were trying to make this film that looked at, kind of on the one hand, we have an abundant and very affordable food system, and on the other hand, we have some sustainability issues and, you know, recalls and food safety crises every other day. So we kind of wanted to look at, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand. But then we also wanted to give the companies the opportunity to respond specifically to some of the things that we found in the course of our filming. So it was kind of, you know, trying to get a broader perspective and then also the very specific.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, what did you say about the film to the companies? Why do you think they turned you down?
You know, I don't think it really had much to do with the film. This is just my opinion, but I think it's just maybe a corporate policy or strategy these days that they're of participating. And I find it rather than...
You're breaking up on us a little bit.
What?
Are you on the cell phone?
Are you on a cell phone?
I am. Are you having a hard time hearing
me?
Yeah,
now it's better. You broke up on us a little bit. It sounded like you were saying that it was a corporate... It wasn't you. It was just a general corporate policy that they wouldn't do this.
That's my opinion, because they didn't know us. You know, I don't think it was personal, but I think the disadvantage for Americans is that we deserve a dialogue. You know, we deserve the opportunity to kind of hear different points of view about our food system. And I just think that it's unfortunate if some of these companies don't want to participate in that dialogue.
How have Monsanto and Tyson and the other companies reacted since the movie was released this past week?
Well, we haven't heard anything from Tyson in particular. Monsanto has a website that they've put up that comments on the film, and there's also been a website that's put together by a lot of the different meat and poultry trade organizations, and they're commenting on it. And I feel like they're trying to, a lot of what particularly this the meat and poultry organizations are actually commenting on things that are not in the film. So it's interesting.
Can you give us an example?
They're saying, you know, that chickens are not raised in cages, and, you know, there's nothing in the film about that. So,
Correct. You had something in the film about them being raised in lightless, I don't know what you would call them, barns or
houses. I think they're called poultry houses. Yeah, there is a story where a farmer lets us into one of her poultry houses, where she raises up to 25,000 chickens.
Now, that farmer was really courageous, and then in the end, she ended up losing her contract. Do you know what happened to her?
Yeah, actually, I just got an email from her the other day. You know, she's getting some attention right now, and she is no longer growing poultry under contract. And she and her they still have the farm, and she and her husband are exploring kind of local food options and to see if they can start to align themselves with a local food network there.
That was just such a poignant story. I don't know if you could elaborate on just kind of the bind that chicken farmers are in this country. And it almost seems like it's not even farming anymore. You know, it's rounding up dead birds and controlling waste, basically.
Right. Well, that's what Carol Morrison, the farmer, says, that she doesn't really feel like she's farming. She feels like she's kind of a slave to the company. It's a contract-based system where the farmer grows for a particular company, and the company provides the birds and the feed, and then, you know, picks them up when they're grown to full weight. But not just Carol, but other contract farmers we met didn't even really know it was in the feed. So for them, you know, for small farmers who have a proud tradition of really knowing everything about their business, it's very hard for them not to, to lose that kind of control. And she wasn't a bind because it's very expensive to build these houses, and to build them, you have to pay off your loan. And
yeah, what was that statistic that the average chicken farmer is like $500,000 in debt?
Yeah, according to our exchanges with the National Chicken Council, they were saying it takes about $250,000 to build a house, one chicken house. So so you know, they get into debt, and then the return on the income every year is not very significant. And then if the company does ask you to upgrade your facilities, you have to, and that's actually why Carol's contract was terminated. The company had asked her to make some, you know, as they call them, upgrades, and she decided it was not something that she wanted to do, so they terminated her contract.
And that upgrade, I'll let our listeners know, she did not follow what the company wanted. The company wanted the chickens to be in a completely lightless enclosure, completely dark, and she had an open, a light-filled area, and she wasn't willing to shutter the chickens in, and that's why she lost her contract. Was it with Purdue? Yeah. I'm wondering if her participation in the film had a factor, do you think?
You know, I wouldn't go that far because she was, I don't remember the exact timing, but when we met her, I think that they had already approached her about doing these upgrades. And I think Carol herself was just in kind of she was kind of at a crossroads trying to figure out what she was going to do and, you know, whether she wanted to get more in debt or whether this was maybe the time to risk losing her contract.
There was another man in the film who lost his livelihood. This time it was because of Monsanto, and he ran a seed cleaning operation. He was actually sort of an older fellow, and Monsanto sued him and essentially put him out of business. Whatever happened to him?
Well, I just spoke with him the other day. He has 17 grandchildren now.
Wow.
Which is really what he wanted to talk about. You know, he is, business is down. I mean, he's a defiant, you know, he's somebody who wants to keep doing what he does. He really loves the service that he provides for farmers, and he is still trying to do that to the best of his ability. But now there are different, you know, it's a very different situation than he had before he was in the lawsuit.
Elise, another poignant theme was just how farmers no longer own any of the process anymore. You know, the chicken farmers, Tyson and Purdue, even give them the chicks, you know, from chicks to processing, they have no control. And then with the soybean farmers and corn farmers, Monsanto and others own the genetically modified seeds. So can you just talk about that a little bit?
Right. I mean, essentially, you know, what this film became was not really so much about, it wasn't just about food. It was about the consolidation of ownership of the food system. And that's been very, very pronounced. I mean, now, since we made the film, there used to be four beef companies that controlled most of the beef. Now there are three. And it's been a trend not just
You're breaking up again.
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
That's better, yeah.
Okay, so sorry about that.
Can you pull over for a minute?
I am pulled over.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on.
It must be the floating satellite thing.
Yeah.
But more and more, you know, there is this intense consolidation, and the story about Monsanto and seeds just really hit home because it's on the very most basic level that there is this ownership and patenting of the building blocks of food, the seeds.
I want to switch the subject just a little bit. This is going a film that goes against big corporations and big money. How did you get funding for this?
Well, the funding for this film came from two companies. The first is Participant Media, and they also funded an Inconvenient Truth, and they do both documentaries and fiction films. And then the other company is River Road Entertainment. And the two of them just decided that they wanted to take a chance with this film. And it wouldn't have been possible without them.
Okay. Well, that's great. What kind of distribution do you have? Has it been hard to get it into the theaters?
Well, actually, it's opening much wider on the 19th, 2 days from now, June 19th.
That's when it opens here in Portland.
At Cinema 21 in Northwest.
I think it's going to be on 45 screens as of Friday, and then it will continue to expand throughout the summer. So we're hoping not just to get it to cities where people might be inclined to be interested, but we also really want to get it out to the farmland.
What kind of outcome reaction do you want people to have from this film? Is there any political change, or what do you want to have happen?
Well, I think what I want to happen, I think it's starting to happen. I think it's igniting a public dialogue. We've gotten a lot of press coverage and a lot of interest in the subject. And I think, you know, there are things that people can do on a very personal level, but on the broader level, having an open public dialogue about what really is the future of our food system, I think is really critical to all of us.
Great. And any topics that you didn't get to explore in the film? I mean, you already covered so much ground. I know.
Yeah, thousands of topics. I mean, we joked that, you know, could have done five films.
A mini series.
We touched upon it very briefly, but I think the issue of antibiotic resistance, the kind of use of antibiotics in livestock production, I think raises some very interesting and important questions. Also, we didn't end up, we had met some people who live near pig production facilities in the South, and a lot of them are suffering from health consequences, and they're concerned about their water. And I think there are many more environmental aspects of this story that we didn't really have the chance to get into.
Yeah, some of that on the pig farms, I think, has even made the national media, which is astounding.
Yep. Definitely.
One last thing. I thought, you brought the Stonyfield Farms thing about, you know, an organic producer selling to Walmart. One thing I was interested in is your view or the background of these big, large food producers now seeing that organics is hot. So you see Del Monte organic bananas and, you know, all that sort of thing. Is that a good or bad thing?
Well, you know, I'll quote Gary from Stonyfield in the film when he's walking around this natural foods expo. He's pointing out all of these, that I think Kellogg's owns Kashi now and Colgate owns Tom's and, you know, these brands that we associate with kind of small health food brands are now owned by bigger corporations. And as he says, the jury's still out. In his opinion, one of the reasons that we put Stonyfield and Walmart in the film was that we didn't want it to be a simple, simple kind of black and white that, you know, small and organic is the only way to go. You know, we have a lot of people to feed, and we think that you can't ignore the role that corporations can play.
Okay, that's an excellent point. We're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon. I just have one last question. Do you eat meat?
Sure. Do I eat meat? Yes, I do.
I'm assuming it's only organic meat or
grass-fed, local.
Or?
When possible. Yes, I do like meat, and I, you know, and also we, that was, that's another thing about the film. We really, it's not an anti, you know, meat eating film. We're not trying to tell everyone to be vegetarians or anything like that. But I think the point is just to try to be aware of where your food comes from. And a lot of times people don't want to know. They want to look the other way. But, you know, really that's what we're trying to say, that you do need to, have some knowledge and awareness of where your food comes from.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Elise Perlstein, who is co-producer of Food Inc. It's coming to Portland this Friday, the 19th, opening at Cinema 21 on Northwest 21st. Both Laura and I thought it was a great movie. Encourage you to see it. Thanks again.
There's no need to despair if you're worried about your food, land, or air. I can tell you that there are people who care. There's no need to be unhappy, people. There's a place you can go where there's research on how to make your plants grow, and some programs that pay the growers some dough, even when they don't plant nothing. It's fun to work with the USDA. It's fun to work with the USDA. Hey, they are everything an agency could be. They look out for you and me. It's fun to work with the USDA. It's fun to work with the USDA.
That was USDA by Dr. Carl Winter, a food safety expert. Coming up now, we have the Jamming for the Hungry program, where Corvallis and Philomath volunteers turn glean fruit into low-sugar jams and jellies for local food banks.
Jams and jellies aren't donated very often. There's a lot of fruit in the Willamette Valley, and there's a lot of people that need the jams and jellies, so put the two together and decided to make it.
That's Sarah Power, who founded the Jamming for the Hungry program at First United Methodist Church in Corvallis in September. Since then, Power and volunteers have canned over 1,300 jars of jam.
Basically, we're canning jams and jellies for local food banks with donated fruit, donated jars, and donated sugar, and donated pectin.
In her years as a food bank volunteer, Power first noticed the need.
At the food bank, sometimes we get donated really top-of-the-line quality, 100% fresh fruit juice. We can give those out for 2 weeks after the sell-by date, but at that point, we have to just pour them down the drain. So instead of just dumping them, I've been pouring a little bit off the top and then freezing them. A few weeks later, I can turn those into jams and jellies. So we've produced a lot of those leftover juices, really quality stuff, pomegranate blueberry and peach papaya mango.
I really enjoy the jams, and what a variety of flavors she has. I think it's wonderful.
Barbara Robinson enjoys Power's jams whenever she visits the Philomath Food Bank.
They get to have toast and jam now, or they couldn't have it before. Well, they have really strange names I can't remember right now. They use mixed fruits, cherries and apples and strawberry, whatever. Whatever fruit is available. They have some that's sugar-free.
I've been using a low-methoxyl pectin. It's less than half the sugar of regular jams and jellies, so it's really a whole lot better for kids to eat. Mostly fruit with a little bit of sugar added instead of being sugar water with a few pieces of fruit floating in it.
Laura Lee Woods, a volunteer at the Philomath Food Bank, appreciates Power's healthy recipes.
It's fresh, and a lot of times, like, the things that are fresh and natural are more expensive, and it's just really nice that she's providing it. Because it's homemade, it's also much healthier.
I asked Dot Richardson, director of the Philomath Food Bank, how customers react when they see the homemade product.
Well, first of all, some of them ask, oh, can you do this? Because they know that ordinarily you can't do that. But we explain to them that this is made in a licensed kitchen, and they're excited about it because it's a special treat for them.
Power, who also directs low-income cooking classes for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, is a tireless volunteer.
I've taken 2 Mondays off since I got started in September. So I'm going to take the month of July off from jamming. And I'm running out of fruit anyway, so I got to wait until I get my fruit store piled up again.
So what keeps her going?
I do this because I really like to be helpful. The jamming project specifically is a really small thing that I can do. It takes me about 3 to 4 hours a week. That's all I do. It's not a big hunk out of my life, so I really enjoy being able to contribute, knowing that I'm spending that time doing something that people really appreciate and benefit from.
Reporting from the Philomath Food Bank, I'm Laura McCandlish.
To you.
All right, so for more information about the Jamming for the Hungry program, you can email Sarah Power at iffpckc@yahoo.com. Again, it's iffpckc@yahoo.com. Next up, we have Linda Ziedrich joining us on the phone from her home in Scio, Oregon. Linda? Are you there?
Yes. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Linda is a freelance writer and editor and the author of cookbooks, including The Joy of Pickling, which was just re-released. And she's here today to talk with us about her new book, The Joys of Jams, Jellies, and Other Sweet Preserves. And just as a side note, she's a homesteader who grows most of the fruits and vegetables she uses at her home. So Linda, how did you happen to turn to jams and jellies with this new cookbook?
Well, I always had a sweet tooth, and I'd been roaming the countryside picking blackberries and wild plums for my mother to make jam with from the time I was a little kid. So I got interested in traditional ways of making jams and other fruit preserves. And there was really only one comprehensive book on the subject, which was published in 1917.
I'm guessing the USDA recommendations have changed since then.
Oh, no. The traditional ways without packaged pectins are not opposed to any USDA recommendations.
Okay.
But this is just the way people used to do it.
Oh, with like the paraffin on top and...
No. If you're going to can your jams or jellies, you follow USDA recommendations for that. But you don't need to go out and buy packaged pectin, because all fruit has pectin in it. It has varying amounts, and it needs acid and adequate sugar to make a gel. You can combine fruits or just vary the amount of sugar as needed to get a good gel. And generally, you end up using less sugar.
Mm. So you try to avoid pectin in your recipes or commercial pectin?
No, I just don't bother to buy it, because once I got into trying things without pectin, I just saw no need to go out and buy it. And so I developed a whole book full of recipes, and they're not all gelled preserves. There are jams, jellies, there's syrups, and there are other things that have a looser texture. some people think that to make jam without pectin, you have to boil the fruit down for a long, long time, and that's generally not true. There's usually not more than 10 minutes of boiling, because the gel does happen.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Sometimes you have failure, and you label it syrup.
Okay, so yeah, which is...
It's not really a problem.
And even jams with vegetables, zucchini, eggplant preserves, where did you get that recipe?
The version I started with in the eggplant preserves was in a cookbook I bought in Spain, and the author didn't say where his original version had come from, but I suspect it's from the Middle East. There are sesame seeds in that one.
Wow. And it's sweet? Huh?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, how unusual.
It's particularly good if you have a lot of eggplant and you don't really like eggplant, because the other flavors can fool you. You may not know you're eating eggplant.
Does every culture make jams and jellies? I mean, is this a cooking technique that unites us all?
No, I wouldn't say that. In different parts of the world, different kinds of sweets are preserved, but the whole idea came probably through Persia and was spread by the Arabs into Europe, and it came from Europe to the United States and other parts of the world and got really popular when refined sugar became available. But I do include a lot of recipes that don't have refined sugar, some with honey.
This is Miriam. I'm Laura's co-host. I was down in Mexico about 2 years ago, and I was staying with a family, and I got a jam that was green. I'm not exactly sure what was in it, but it was sort of sweet but spicy. They put like some chilies or something in it. Is that just a regional Mexican thing, or?
I don't know what that would be, but pepper jellies and jams are popular in the United States. Too, so it could be like one of our pepper jellies or jams.
Oh, okay. I guess I hadn't had one of those here. And the other thing is I lived in Germany for a while, and they sell specific jamming sugar. So it's like sugar that has the pectin in it already?
Yeah, they do in France, too. And I haven't talked with anybody who's actually used those sugars, but it means that you can't change the amount of pectin that you're using without changing the amount of sugar, so that I think it would be somewhat limiting depending on the fruit you're using.
But now I know in our last story, Jamming for the Hungry, Sarah Power uses low methoxyl pectin, so that at least doesn't require any sugar.
Yes, and I really like low methoxyl pectin. If I'm going to use packaged pectin, usually that's what I'll go for. And the advantage of that is that you can use less sugar or no sugar because it gels in the presence of calcium instead of sugar.
And that's also key with there's so many diabetics these days. So that's Pomona's Universal Pectin usually is where you see it, what you see it sold under.
Yeah, there's Pomona, which I think comes with the calcium separate, or at least it used to, and it's usually sold in natural food stores. Supermarkets, though, generally have at least one type of low methoxyl pectin, probably Sure Gel. I don't know if there's an MCP one, probably. I don't remember. And it will be labeled for low sugar or no sugar recipes.
So for anyone looking to make jam for the first time, where would you recommend getting started?
I would recommend starting with a small quantity and making just about a pint, because then you don't have to worry about canning it, and you're likely to get a good gel with a smaller amount of cooking. This time of year, you might start with strawberries, and because strawberries are a soft fruit, they don't need to be cooked before sugar is added, so you can just cut them, chop them, or mash them, combine them with sugar, say a pound of strawberries to a cup of sugar with a little bit of lemon juice for acidity to make sure that they gel. And with a few minutes of cooking, you'll have a nice strawberry jam.
And would you just put that in the refrigerator or do a freezer jam?
If you're not going to eat it right away, it should go in the refrigerator. And it could also be stored in the freezer.
How long would it keep in the refrigerator?
Oh, I would say at least a month.
Oh, but not longer. But I'm guessing a pint of...
It could keep much longer, but, you know, you have to watch for mold.
Mm-hmm. But I'm guessing a pint of strawberry jam would go
probably
quickly.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Can you make it out of frozen fruit as well?
Yes, and I do that all the time. It's not so fun to spend a lot of time in the kitchen in the summer when you want to be outside. You want to be in your garden or taking a walk somewhere. So I freeze a lot of fruit in the summer and then make it into jam or other things in the winter.
And what do you have what are you focusing on in your garden this spring and summer that will be turned into jam?
I'm still playing around with rhubarb, which will keep producing for a while. And I have ripe strawberries. I've also been doing things with roses. I like to make a rose petal preserve. It's a very special treat. I like the rugosa roses and the wild roses that are very aromatic. And so a few weeks ago, I made some rose petal preserves. And those are kind of past now, but I still have a moss rose. Pink moss rose that's very aromatic, and another old rose that's been on this farm forever, a climber, I don't know what it is, but the petals of both of those are very nice to add to strawberry preserves or jam.
Okay, we also wondered if any of you listeners out there, and I'll remind you, listening to the KBOO Food Show on 90.7 FM, and we're talking about jamming with Linda Ziedrich. And if you have any questions for her about jamming or preserving or that sort of thing, you could call us at 503-231-8187. I have a question as someone who's never done this before. What is the common beginner's mistake? I thought we lost you there.
Here's one. If you boil your jam too long because you don't recognize that it's starting to gel, you can go past the gel point and you'll end up with a syrup. So that's one.
I guess that's not horrible because you could pour that over ice cream. So.
That's right.
So, Linda, we're going to post your recipe for strawberry rose petal jam on the website after the show, kboo.fm/foodshow. So would you just tell us a little bit more about that recipe? Rose petal jam sounds so nice. What kind of roses do you use?
As I said, right now I would use my moss roses, which are pink, but they tend to lose their color, so I don't use those for rose petal preserves, or my climber, which has white petals with just a blush. But the color doesn't matter so much because our strawberries in Oregon are so red. They're generally, the preferred varieties are red through and through, and you get a really red jam or preserves from them. And I think the recipe you're actually going to post is for strawberry preserves, and this is preserves in the narrow sense, which means whole or cut fruit in a thick syrup, which may or may not be gelled. This is something that people used to eat with the spoon, and they still do in parts of southern and eastern Europe and the Mideast. But in the U.S., people often prefer to spread it on toast or on put it on ice cream. So it's a little more jammy than many preserves. But the way you generally make preserves in the narrow sense is you mix the fruit with sugar in a bowl. You layer them together. And then you let the bowl set so that the sugar draws the liquid out of the fruit. So with strawberries, you end up with a strawberry sitting in this red syrup, and there may be some sugar left in there. And the strawberries end up kind of shriveled up. They're smaller. And so then you heat that mixture, and the strawberries start to plump up again, and you let it sit again, say, overnight, and then you cook up the mixture. And usually you'll get, with my recipe, you'll get a lightly gelled mixture with hunks of strawberry. Now, if you buy California strawberries or some of the Oregon ones that are sold now, too, are very large.
Linda, we have a call for you.
Oh, okay.
Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, Linda, this is relating to strawberries, as a matter of fact. We used to have in Oregon, they used to grow Marshall strawberries, which did not, like you said, get real big. And they were good for fresh eating and for jam. But they had just such a wonderful flavor, and I have been searching for a while. You know of any place where one can get Marshall strawberries? I'll take my
own strawberries. I just went to a strawberry field day where the researchers told a story of Marshall strawberries, and they had collected what were called Marshall strawberries from various sources and planted them all and grew them, and then had a fellow, I don't remember if he was a scientist or a farmer, but an expert on Marshall strawberries who remembered what they were like, come and tell them, now, which one is really the Marshall, because they were all different. And he picked one out, and I don't remember the specifics, but everybody felt it was not that good, that strawberry varieties have actually improved since then, and people remember that Marshall strawberries being really wonderful, but the varieties we have today are actually better tasting and more productive.
Okay,
thanks, Paul. Caller. If anybody else has questions, it's 503-231-8187.
So, Linda, what jams can we look forward to later in the summer? I saw you had a recipe for cantaloupe jam with mint.
Yeah, that's a really good thing to do if you grow melons and end up with too many, because that can happen. And the cantaloupe, I was amazed that cantaloupe makes good jam because it seemed like such a watery fruit to me. But it makes a beautiful jam, similar in color to peach jam, and the cantaloupe flavor really comes through with a wonderful perfume. Vanilla is also a nice flavoring to go with cantaloupe in jam.
What would you do with that? Would you pair that with a meat or?
I don't think I'd pair it with meat. I think maybe it's a little too delicate for that, but it's certainly wonderful on bread or to eat with a spoon or with ice cream. I think I'd keep it with the desserts.
Are there any jams in particular that you'd use more in a savory combination?
Perhaps the eggplant, but definitely the pepper jams and jellies and bitter ones, the marmalades. Are very good with meat.
And any cookbooks you're dreaming up next? You're pretty prolific with your pickling book and your jamming.
Actually, it took me an awful long time to do these books, and I think the next one will be a book about food, but maybe not a recipe book.
Okay. Well, there's a big market for that now as well. I'm actually going through the Master Food Preservers program myself through Oregon State University's Extension Service, and I saw that you'd completed that program as well as the Master Gardeners program. How is Extension or Outreach Services a resource for people looking to jam or can at home?
Or garden?
They're excellent. Actually, I took the Master Gardener program in Massachusetts, so I can't personally speak about
it. But just even across the country.
Program here, but a lot of my friends have taken it, and they just love it. Both programs are just excellent for getting started. They give you all the basics. They give you other enthusiasts to talk with. They give you experience, and they give you volunteer opportunities. They're a great place to start.
Great. And I know there's sometimes some debate over, you know, how strictly you need to follow the USDA regulations. Anything to discuss in light of food safety with jams and jellies? I guess I feel like jams are less intimidating than canning low-acid vegetables. I mean, the sugar acts as a preservative in a way.
That's right. Generally, the only things that can go wrong is you can get mold in the jar, or you can get some fermentation, usually after the jar is open. And you notice those things, you're not going to get sick from that. But the way to keep from getting mold in the jar is to fill the jar so there's only a quarter inch of space at the top. And if sterilize the jars by boiling them beforehand and then process them for 5 minutes, or if you don't want to deal with sterilizing the jars, process them for 10 minutes, just a little bit longer.
How would you sterilize jars, just in your dishwasher?
You can do it in your dishwasher if your dishwasher has a heating function so that the water can get hotter than your water heater makes it. Or you can use a boiling water bath. Just put the jars into a pot with something on the bottom so they're not touching a rack on the bottom so they're not touching the bottom of the pot.
All right. Well, great. Thanks so much, Linda. And now we're going to give away your Jams and Jellies cookbook to the third person to call in at 503-231-8032. Again, it's 503-231-8032 to win a copy of The Joys of Jams, Jellies, and Other Sweet Preserves. Thanks so much, Linda. We'll have you back on to discuss pickling.
Okay, thank you, Laura. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Unite, for life is worth much more than gold. We're jamming,
jamming, jamming, jamming.
And we're jamming in the name of the Lord. We're jamming. Seated in Mount Zion, it rules all creation. Yeah, we're jamming. Fuck you, wah, wah, wah. We're jamming. See, I wanna jam it with you. We're jamming. So jam by my side. We're jamming,
jamming, jamming, jamming.
I wanna jam it with you. We're jamming, 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 we're jamming. Hope you like jamming too. We're jamming, we're jamming,
jamming,
we're jamming, we're jamming.
I'm Laura McCandlish, and welcome back to the KBOO Food Show. You can hear us at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, or live stream at kboo.fm. And just a reminder, digital file of the show will be up on our website at kboo.fm/foodshow. Now we are going to go to a piece from the Oregon State University Extension Service Master Food Preservers Program. I have been taking part in this 8-week course myself, where I'm learning all things canning, from jamming to pickling to dehydrating. I grew up a child of the 80s. My mother stopped canning tomatoes before I was able to learn, so I'm really discovering this all for the first time. Linda Ziedrich, the cookbook author we just heard from, has gone through this program, and as well Sarah Power, full disclosure, who started the Jamming for the Hungry program in Corvallis, is also going through the program with me. So it's a great place for people to get started and then share these skills in the community. So we're going to go ahead and go to this piece.
Oh, I'm Janice Gregg. I'm OSU Extension Service Extension faculty.
And how long have you been teaching food preservation?
27 years.
So we're working with a real veteran. And some of the people in our class, we've got
Kelly Strawn. I work at Heavenly Harvest Farm.
And you guys donated the apples and rhubarb today.
You've got to suit the fruit to the method that you're going to preserve. And is it going to taste as good after you preserve it as you began? Then you're okay. Right. But it's going to be a different product in the end. All right, okay, get your jars. If you want to warm your jars, take them over, kind of dip them in the water, warm the jars up. Then put the apples in here and get the syrup as well. Add enough juice to just cover, and that's a half inch head space right there. Then we'll wipe that off. Take off any juice or little bits of apple that might have gotten on there. It gets even more critical when you have something like salsa or lots of little bits and pieces that can get on it. Here, this is pretty clean because they're plain apples and juice. Fingertip tight, and you're ready to go. Now, because I filled this jar, I'm going to put my symbol on here so I get it when it comes out of the canner.
Now, would you use the same method for canning peaches or another kind of tree fruit?
It depends on if you want it. This is what kind of pack?
Hot pack.
This is hot pack, right.
Light syrup. Extra light syrup.
We are experimenting with these, and we're going to put different syrups in each one of the grape jars, each one of the pint jars filled with grapes. And then we're going to taste them in a couple weeks and see which ones we like. Light, extra light, heavy, honey, maybe sweetener, fruit juices, no sugar.
So you could can grapes just in water?
You can can any fruit in water. Now, sometimes it turns out tasting really good, and other times it tastes kind of...
Janice, whenever I ever canned anything, I was always told that I needed to run the knife down the side to take the bubbles out. I mean, is that true or not?
You know, you see little bubbles come up right there. But make sure you use not metal.
Otherwise it won't seal.
No, it'll seal, but that part of the fruit will discolor.
Because I just use a knife.
metal scores the inside of the jar, and it will have a tendency to break a little bit faster.
And when it says inch and a half headspace, they are serious. I do a lot of gift giving. When they can look at the jar and see how much fruit is in there. If you open a can of Wilderness and pour it in a bowl, and you open a quart of mine and pour it in the bowl, there's no comparison. This has got berries throughout. The Wilderness has gel. And forbearing. I keep it on the shelf more than a year to year and a half. It will separate, but you stir it up, put it in the pie. When your pie is baked, it thickens right back up.
You said in addition to blueberries, you do marionberry.
Cherry.
We are working on gingered spring jam, and we are cutting up and crushing some strawberries.
Now, are you macerating them with sugar? Or this is just
not yet.
Okay,
we are just cutting them and mashing them and measuring them so that we have enough
crystallized ginger.
I know.
That's such a great idea.
But ginger is very healthy for you, so that sounds good.
Yeah, and it's so perfect that strawberries and rhubarb both come into the market about the same time.
I had planted a rhubarb plant last year, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I didn't do anything, and it did its thing. This year, it's starting to come up, so I'm very excited to do this recipe because then I can go home and use something that I have at home growing that's ready.
Yeah,
My name is Tanya Mergedich, and I had taken some home economics when I was in high school and junior high over 20 plus years ago. I was raised in a grocery store and fast food restaurant. I learned how to cook from everybody in my family, except I really liked the canning and freezing, and I'm trying to explore that now in my life so I could teach it to my kids.
For this gingered spring jam, we're using natural fruit pectin, the gel, which is from apples, and I guess the powdered pectin, citrus kind, MCP. This is a lot of sugar, 5.5 cups of sugar. Six half pints of jam. What would you use lime jelly for? Is it kind of like more like a marmalade?
On my toast.
This is Laura McCandlish back with the KBOO Food Show. Those were some scenes from my Master Food Preservers class through the Oregon State University Extension Service. I really encourage you guys to sign up for some of their programs if you're trying to learn jamming, jellies, or any other type of canning. You can go to the Extension Service website. That's eesc.oregonstate.edu. Again, it's eesc.oregonstate.edu. The Extension Service also has food safety and food preservation information. And if you have any questions about jamming, they have a hotline, a food preservation hotline you can call between July and October. That's 1-800-354-7319. Again, it's 1-800-354-7319. Happy jamming.
Hi, this is Miriam back again. And first, I want to say that we have a winner for the cookbook, Mark from Portland. Congratulations. We also had a caller who wanted to know about when the loganberry season starts. I'm not 100% positive. I actually went out with my kids to pick strawberries a couple of days ago, and I was hoping the raspberries were going to get going, and that is not the case for at least another week. And the best of my recollection, and don't quote me on this, is that the loganberries come in a little bit after the raspberries.
I don't even know what a loganberry is.
I don't know. I don't know how I can describe it.
It's kind of sweet. Is it like a grape? Look, that's a gooseberry.
No, I think it's a darker color, but...
We need to do a berry show.
We should definitely do a berry show, especially now. They're really coming in strong. Like I said, raspberries next week, and then after that, sort of all of the berries kind of follow along the line. We're wrapping up our show here, and I just wanted to give you a couple of heads up on some things. I've been a contributing reporter to Julie Sabatier's Destination DIY show, which used to air right here on KBOO, but is now airing as a podcast and might eventually air on OPB. Julie is doing a show coming up on June 25th that's about representing yourself. And I did this rather humorous piece about internet dating and how people represent themselves or misrepresent themselves on the internet in the hopes of finding romance. So look for that. There is a listening party at the Waypost at 7 p.m., which is a cafe in North Portland, on June 25th, the date that the podcast is being released. And we also want to say a couple things about what's coming up on the food show. Our next food show is July 15th.
At 11 a.m. Well, Miriam, all this internet dating, I hear it's given you a chance to think about food and dates a fair amount.
Yeah, and actually, as part of the July 15th show, we're going to open things up to callers, and we're going to have a little segment about what to eat on a first date.
So avoid the garlic.
Actually, sometimes you need that if you want to get rid of the person. I have some amusing stories of my own, but I'd love to hear listener stories about successes or failures of food stories about what to eat on the first date and what sort of meal did you do? Is it always dinner or do you meet for breakfast the first time or something else?
A little midnight snack. And we will also look at Portland's evolving food cart culture. The latest place to open is a Korean taco stand, and take you to Chef Naoko's Bento Box Cafe, perhaps the best place to lunch in Portland. But, of course, I live in Corvallis, so what do I know?
I'm sure lots of people have lots of different opinions about what's the best place to eat. So that's what's coming up on our show. Mark the date, July 15th at 11 a.m.
You can hear this archive show at kboo.fm/foodshow. We'll post it later this afternoon.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the KBOO Food Show on 90.7 FM. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Laura McCandlish.
Everybody's in the same.